this is a conversation with Anne-Marie Early and David Glancer. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
So you do relational focusing. Could you maybe talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
We would love to. So saying that we do relational focusing, we're probably more introducing an idea to the focusing world, where hopefully we're using the foundation of what focusers do so well, which is activating the intrapersonal implicit and working with that space. And taking that from just kind of the internal, where the felt sense of the inside meets the kind of thinking of the explicit, and using that same space, but doing it in the interpersonal implicit, which is the space between two people, and making sure that you're continuing to work in that implicit felt sensing place, activating what we really believe are alive potentials.
I want to interrupt you, because as I have the possibility of watching you while you speak, you're having a very rich body language as you're talking. And I think that is such a nice way to add, you know, to what you're saying. So I'm going to try to describe a little bit what I was seeing. As you're talking about intrapersonal focusing, you have your hand going up and down between the head and the gut area. And then you're talking about, you're staying for a moment in the gut area as you're talking about, you know, what's happening. And then your hand is moving back up toward the head. And so that's a description of what's happening in the intrapersonal focusing. And then you have this hand gesture toward the outside. And that's where you go into replicating this process in the interpersonal focusing.
Yeah, lovely. Mm-hmm. Very nicely said. Anything you would add, David, that?
I think just simply to recognize that both of those processes are happening, you know, when we have that extension of ourself into the interpersonal space, the intrapersonal conversation in both people is still continuing. So it becomes a very, very rich dialogue between, it's not that you do either the intrapersonal implicit or the interpersonal implicit, it's that those are simultaneous.
Yes, yes.
And we also add a transpersonal implicit as well, where, as we experience in focusing, very often an aliveness captures the moment. That is perceived as something in a larger field of possibility, and the larger field of relationship.
Yeah. So what I'm picking up there is that, in a way, instead of just calling something aliveness, you're describing this aliveness as a relationship. And in that case, a relationship to a larger field. So in other words, even your description of what happens in each case is relational.
I really like the language of relational more than I do the language of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels to me like the relationship reifies already something that is a dynamic process.
Mm-hmm. So relational talks about we're in a process.
And really playing with and understanding the difference between what's implicit and what's explicit. Too often when it moves to the relational dimension, as we're sitting with someone in the clinical relationship or focusing together, it can actually move and become a cognitive process. And so this is really encouraging people to trust and value what Ian McGilchrist talks about, this kind of right hemisphere way of knowing that's open, it's scanning the environment, it's the felt sensing realm that focusers know so well that now neuroscience is saying is incredibly important. It's actually where genius comes from. And then translating it to the explicit, it's learning to work in that realm between two people or in a group or the larger surround, and sit in that ambiguous space together to wait and see what's actually showing up.
Yeah. So I think I like the way that you're relating implicit, you know, which can be an abstract word, to the last phrase you were using, you know, wait in that ambiguous place to see what's going to happen. And it feels like a very nice way to not reify a word like the implicit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, in a place that, as Jelen says, is that it is not yet formed.
Mm-hmm.
And to not only be comfortable with that inside myself, but be comfortable of that in relationship with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To recognize that together we are sharing some forming space.
Yes. Yes.
And it can be an uncomfortable place. It's one thing to do it inside of yourself, but to engage that unformed, not yet showing up felt sensing place, not just in my experience that I tell you about, but actually creating a space where we're in this together, it can be uncomfortable. And so this is where we really believe helping people play with the space to stay in the place of practicing, feeling different energies, how you shift and change helps people to open up to sitting in that ambiguous space with another person, not moving it up. Because when we become uncomfortable, we move it up into the explicit and we try to make sense of it and we try to talk our way around something. So it's less a process. I mean, it's less a method than it is a process of
yes.
being able to become comfortable with these spaces and to know the difference in your fingertips, to know the difference between when we're talking about something, which is slightly removed, and when we're actually in something that is moving us along, that has kind of generative capacity of its own.
Right. So, in essence, what you're talking about is a very simple how-to process of, you know, we all, when we do focusing, we have the intention of staying in the implicit. And what you're saying is, okay, if you want to be there, you have to be aware to develop the capacity to know when you are versus when you're not, when you're, you know, more inside versus when it's coming up and going there. And understanding that probably some markers are going to have to do with some degree of discomfort that you're going to feel because mm-hmm. you know, when you're in discomfort, you're going to tend to want to go up.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think attachment theory is so tremendously helpful because it talks about how it's a wired in mammalian kind of human capacity to need to connect. And the regulation of emotion is tremendously significant. And Ed Tronick's research on rupture and repair, especially with mothers and infants, that secure attachment is not built on always getting it right. It's in the misses and the ruptures and the reconnections where real secure attachment is built. And it's the same thing when we're working in this interpersonal implicit space. It's when it goes off and we can tolerate that and get back to the rightness of connection that we get it, that our bodies actually get, aha, the difference of that. Look what shows up when we can sit in that space together. And we can do something in relationship that I can't do just within myself.
Yeah.
It happens when we are in this together that is unique than from my just doing this within myself, my own organism.
Yeah.
And the capacity and discomfort of being in that implicit space of another person is something very much different than just simply taking turns. First I'm in my implicit, then you're in your implicit, and then I'm in my implicit. Are we taking turns focusing? It's more that we are sharing the space of implicit together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's an additional kind of potential discomfort, but also then on the positive side, so much more potential aliveness as well.
So as the both of you are talking, what comes to mind is a visual and a sense of if we had a monitor, you know, with, you know, like in medical shows where they show you a line going up and down. And if you have a flat line, in a way, the person is dead. And what I'm getting from you is that if your expectation of what happens in focusing is something that's going to be a flat line, then basically you don't have the richness of it. And if you have some ups and downs and some, you know, difficult moments, it's actually what the process is about, because you're not going to have the richness without having some of that rupture and repair.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in this place, it's one thing when we're focusing on the intrapersonal, but what's wonderful in this interpersonal space is we can take kind of all of this neuroscience that's talking about mirror neurons, how we impact each other, nonverbal communication, and how do we actually read those signals, that implicit. It's looking at how we dyadically regulate and co-regulate each other, being in the same space together. Dan Goleman's research on social intelligence and how you actually pick up those cues and work with them. So the fun thing is, I would throw in Jaak Panksepp here. Another person I'll throw in a minute, mm-hmm. but Jaak Panksepp talks about the play system being activated. And then if we talk about Stephen Porges, the window of tolerance, you don't want so much that you're flooded, but not enough that nothing's happening. So that would be your flat line again. When you're in that optimum level of arousal, it's what he calls the social engagement system. Mm-hmm. And it's a relational system that actually that's where we move the best in the world. Yeah. So it's living in that space.
Yeah. So maybe to restate what you've said a bit is that sense of that bandwidth that you're describing of the social engagement system is mm-hmm. where, you know, the richness of human interaction happens. And it happens not just in a way moment to moment, you know, in a given interaction, but mm-hmm. it's where we learn interaction. That's where it comes, you know, from childhood on, and so what this is about is getting into that kind of bandwidth as opposed to a narrower one.
Yes. Yeah.
And getting into the already relational space, flipping things around, not to say that you and I each have to be individuals and then we create the relational space. It's that we are in relational space and can emerge from that. And so that this bandwidth we're talking about is a kind of a mutuality. I'm getting stuck there.
So maybe let me just pick up what you might have said. You started with entering into the already relational field as mm-hmm. opposed to each being, you know, in some place and then connecting. So then, I'm wondering if maybe you were talking about, you know, in a way what that field is and how that field affects us as we're into this process.
Right. And what we're talking about bandwidth would be actually getting into the place where you can both sense and speak into
mm-hmm.
that.
This is where Dan Stern talked about moments of meeting that were more kairos moments, alive with potential, than chronos, actual lived time. And he talked about this kind of inner subjective space that gets created. And I'm just bringing up on a PowerPoint that creative genius, I just want to read this, is the willingness and ability to sit in the not knowing state of active curiosity. This is what focusers do on the inside all the time. We just want to translate it.
So let's just read it again slowly, just because that's a nice place to stay in and let it sink in.
Good. Well, let's play there a little bit.
Yeah.
There's three things. So the first part of creative genius, and this is referencing Baron, willingness and ability to sit in not knowing states of active curiosity. So that's the felt sensing realm.
Yeah.
Place where we go into this place and we wait for something to come and we don't have to have answers. We just believe that space so much that it's going to guide us and that it has the wisdom that we enter it freely inside of ourselves.
And so maybe the part to add there, again, if we're just kind of going you know, along nodding and so on, everybody would say, yeah, 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 that's what I do, of course. But I think the part to recognize is maybe all of our evolution is actually gearing up to not wanting to not know, because it's important to know in order to avoid danger. So we're going to have primed to actually not be able to sit with the not knowing and to quickly make conclusions. So this is some kind of a counterintuitive movement that we have to learn, because if we just were doing what we naturally do, we wouldn't do it.
Well, I would add to that, and David's going to speak here as well, but I would say, yes, in our culture particularly, we are, and this is going back to McGilchrist, where he talks so eloquently in his book, The Master and His Emissary, that the master really is the right hemisphere, that more open-ended, curious, taking in all kinds of data. And the emissary, the one who serves, really should be the left hemisphere, the one that after the experience translates. But we flip them culturally.
Yeah.
The left hemisphere rules. And so we've lost what just we have lost our greatest wise guide on the inside that actually and this is where people who are true geniuses, who are true masters, like Einstein knew. The best thoughts come from sitting in the park on a bench and not thinking about anything. And then all of a sudden the hit happens and then they translate it to their thinking brain. It's honoring that space, not just within us, but in relationship with the other that we're trying to point to.
Well, and I was going to reference McGilchrist too. There really are two kinds of not knowing. And as Jenlyn said, you wouldn't want to fly in an airplane that was designed by a not
Yeah.
So, you know, even in the mammalian, the bird brain, the one part of the brain has to be open to whatever might come along, and you don't know what that is. You don't know what the next predator might be or look like, but you have to have a part of you that has a kind of knowing that is very organized in particular and can differentiate seeds from gravel. And so I think what the genius of focusing has been is it really recognizes the interaction and the dialogue between those two kinds of not knowing and knowing. And then how do we move that into that interpersonal space and, you know, actually even take the risk of being in someone else's emergent implicit. I mean, coming from the practice of focusing where I really value being companion or being the companion to a focuser, as a companion, I am often so cautious of not inserting myself into their process. And really what we're talking about here when we talk about interpersonal presence and interpersonal focusing is actually this mutual getting in each other's space.
Yeah.
In each other's implicit place, not having a discussion or an argument about it, but that place where we're going, what's that together?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm hearing two things, and I want to just voice both of them, and both have to do in a way with the relational. And there's one thing you describe, and you say that it's not a question of one type of brain being better than the other, but it's actually the negotiating, the understanding, the going between one and the other, the relationship, the exchange between both of them that is enriching focusing. Mm-hmm. And the other part is making the point that you have to have, that the interpersonal focusing is going to involve some kind of a negotiation, some kind of putting each person in, because otherwise you don't have two people being involved in the process.
That's right.
Very nicely said. That was beautifully put.
And
I just want to say this as somebody who's not actually part of the focusing community, but has loved being with focusers and being at the conference and talking, is focusing is more current today at the cutting edge of the field than it ever has been. And neuroscience is pointing us in that direction, that it is supporting what Jenlyn has talked about for decades, is becoming current and new to us therapists. That this is actually really, really important. What I want to say is, so as focusers, to not create another method that people do in this interpersonal space, but to engage what the real underneath process is? What's the energy below the surface that if they activate it in that relational space, they will set themselves out at the cutting edge of really leading what I believe is not just the focusing world, but the field, moving it on, being able to help people engage these spaces in right. really alive, generative ways.
So, what I'm hearing is something about, it's not a method so much as it is a kind of narrative that allows you to see what is, that makes you sensitive to to the currents that are, that of what happens in an interpersonal relationship.
Yes. And so if I go back to that creative genius, it was the number one was willingness or ability to sit in that not knowing state of active curiosity. So you do that in relationship with another person. Number two is deep sense of unwavering unshakability once a conviction is developed. Isn't that in the intrapersonal world? What happens is once you get that felt sense, you know it. You know it as truth. It is as if, you know, the lights went on. It's learning in that interpersonal implicit space to wait for that to come in relationship as well. Being able to tolerate the discomfort, the ambiguity, the anxiety, which if we don't name it as such, will take us over and flood us or make us shut down. This is the place where we have to help people, and I use the word play intentionally, to play in that space so they become comfortable with it. Not create a method where they have to get it right, but have exercises and practices and creative ways of feeling this space when it's there, when it's not there, so you know it. Just like you know the one on the inside, you know it in that relational space.
Yeah. So maybe again to mention some of your body language and the way you move your hands. And so a sense, and as I follow you and I listen to you, that it's as if the air, the space, the field, what's happening between people as they're focusing is something that has a tangible quality. And you're taking some play and molding it, but maybe not so much molding play as feeling something and trying to grope and get a sense of what it is, which is the language that we sometimes use in focusing in terms of connecting intrapersonally. But you're talking about having that curiosity, that awareness of that tangible quality in the field of interpersonal relationship.
Exactly. And if I read this is the third and last piece of creative genius, you just let us right there, is an appreciation of paradoxes, contradictions, and other forms of both and logic. So we're in this place of things don't have to fit together neatly. There can be things that have both and qualities, and we tolerate that together. And I believe because we're wired, you know, attachment theory, kind of that mammalian connection, that when we get good at doing that, and some cultures do this much better than we do in their cultural practices, it allows kind of potentials to arise that I actually think are not just helpful and facilitative. I would actually go and call them transformational.
Yeah.
For these spaces, transformation is possible. Quick change, shifts, dramatic unfoldings, epiphanies. All different kind of places on the inside open up I believe, very surprising ways.
So maybe something about the nature that having contradictory thing, ambivalent things, different, is anxiety provoking. But being in relationship and feeling that relationship is like a container that makes it possible to hold that danger long enough so that something can come out of it, and so their transformation is possible because there is that resource of having the attachment, the connection.
And the contradiction and the paradox really is what creates the space for yet another voice.
Yes.
So that when this emergent resolution comes, it's not us necessarily making it up or producing it. It's us being receptive to the implicit potentials that are bigger than we are.
So that's a space, in a way, what you're talking about is in a dyad, in a dialogue, there's actually three. there's you, me, and the field, and it's about listening to the field for answers as opposed to seeking answers alone or simply from each other.
Right. And field sounds so impersonal in a way, and if you think, I like to think of it as a field, but a field in which, or a stage in which aliveness can come, action can come. It's the same way in intrapersonal focusing, where something comes alive, I can actually ask it questions. I can query it. I can say, what do you need? What do you want? There can be, in a similar way, in the interpersonal field or the interpersonal space between us, particularly when we're comfortable with that paradox and contradiction, something begins to emerge with that initial faintness that Jen Lynn talks about, that initial fuzziness. And so we ask it, what is it? Who's here? What do you want? What do you have to say to us? And it's a what do you have to say to us that I think this brings us to what we had said at the beginning of the interview, was that third kind of implicit, the transpersonal implicit.
So that it's something that we're paying attention to right now in a dyad, but in a way that any focuser, even people who simply have mostly done focusing in an intrapersonal way, right, can relate to, because as a focuser, you have the experience that there is something, however way you describe it, that you can ask question to. And it's not just, you know, asking yourself question in a regular way, but mm-hmm. we ask it, we ask the felt sense, we ask, and what you're talking about is that is also going to be present in a dyad, in a dialogue.
That's right. And we ask the felt sense, or in Jen Lynn's other beautiful concept, we ask the client's client.
Mm-hmm.
So that in some sense, both we and the client can be empathic with this other, this third party, the client's client, and that we can both have the relationship with that, that puts us almost more on an equal basis than me having to go through the client to be empathic with their client.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So we're both in a relationship listening to that client's client.
Right.
Yeah.
There get to be too many clients, right?
and I would love to just to use the words attunement and resonance.
Yeah.
That we have our own internal attunement, but we also need to attune to the space and to the person in front of us. And when we are in attunement and we get that connection, a resonant state actually creates potentials that otherwise weren't there. And learning to attend to when resonance is there and when resonance isn't there, we have this, our graduating class this year gave us one of those crystal quartz singing bowls. It's just this little singing bowl that's about 12 inches. But when you get that resonant harmony going, it is so piercing it can probably break windows. So that resonant vibration, But it takes time to get attuned to the bowl. It doesn't sing at first. It might take you 5 minutes to actually get that bowl to sing. And boy, when it sings, watch out. It's paying attention to that same kind of attunement inside yourself, not losing that skill that focusers have, but that bringing it out into that interpersonal realm and being comfortable naming when it's there and when it's not there, not in an explicit way, but in a way where we pay attention together to how is this feeling? Does it feel like this is right? You know, it feels like there's something funny. We play around with that space like Play-Doh or with something. And then when we get in that lock or that sink or that resonant state, we train ourselves to know what that is. And when we're there, we pay attention to it. We honor it. We use that space with intentionality. Many people get out of that space really quickly because mm-hmm. it can be very uncomfortable. So we're learning really to use that kind of musicality of attunement and resonance. We don't lose our individuality in that place. We are here on a campus where people sing four-part harmony without any instrumentation. And to listen to them, we had an attachment conference here about 3 years ago where Dan Siegel was talking about flow and used music. And so we had 1,500 people singing four-part harmony in this stadium. Wow. Listening to this beautiful resonant quality of how do you listen to each other and yet hold your own individuality. And again, we're in this culture where musically they've learned to do that. We want to do that interpersonally and in group settings to really honor that space and let new potentials bubble up from there.
So I want to maybe stay with that example you give of four-part harmony. And especially if you have a crowd of 1,500 people, because one of the things that people would say on the surface, being, you know, describing something like this, would be, oh, you lose yourself in it. And what you're describing is actually, in order to be able to do that, you have to not lose yourself, because you have to be able to notice what's happening, and there is a constant monitoring. So it's a beautiful example of how you can be with the group and at the same time be very acutely aware of your existence as a person, because this is actually what is going to enable you to perform your part in the group.
And what was so interesting in this actual experience is we have a very well-respected choral leader. We made up our own song. So we had to sit in this amazing discomfort of dissonance because we didn't know what we were singing. There was no score to follow. So we were just in this ambiguous place. Many of us had absolute trust in him because we know, but we didn't know what was going to show up. And I think it was about 10 minutes of getting to this place of a song coming, and it showed up. And then it was sung. I mean, it gives me chills to think about. It was powerful.
It sounds like it, yeah.
That really is the perfect example, a beautiful example of being a participant in something larger than yourself that really makes you larger. You don't lose yourself. You find yourself in a new way.
Yeah. And so the closest we would get to calling anything a model would be to learn to play with those spaces around, walk towards each other, figure out how you track each other, play in that space, then do your own intrapersonal attunement, find a way to attune interpersonally, open up the space for once you have resonance for something to show up, let that be what it is. And then bring it back, whatever it is, back into yourself, where you can still have your own unique experience of whatever you encountered in that space can then have a very different meaning for me to take inside myself and for David to take inside of him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be an answer. It's an alive experience.
Yeah. But so you're describing something that is a process of going inside, being open to what's happening, getting a sense of it, going back inside. And so there is that sense of hearing, coming out, that negotiation that comes in, and where you're both open to what's happening outside, to what's happening inside, and that sense that what you're giving back is something that is processed. You're not just a passive recipient of it.
And in that place, I mean, you can do it so many different ways. I mean, it could be in a therapy situation where the therapist is doing the attunement and working on resonance with their client, with the client not even necessarily knowing. It could be in two people who are in a joint venture trying to create that sense of attunement within and then resonance together that opens up, you know, creative potentials for writing or doing personal work. So it could be all kinds of different things. And so in this place, what you have to then name is this is about entering a different state. So it's entering what I would call an alive trance state, that I believe the best meditation is relational in nature, because it creates that kind of open state. And I don't have the best language to put on it, except for to say when we're in that place of maybe receptive trance state or something. I don't know, David, do you have a better word than that? That it's a holding container. It's a way of being in presence, a way of listening, where the space actually begins to hold you differently. And even just pointing out to people when they come into a noisy room and kind of feeling the quality of that, I mean, just the bubbling of whatever's in the air around you, helping them to attune on the inside, feeling what that's like, helping them to attune with another person and get in resonance, what that's like. At that point, they actually stop listening to you because they're kind of in sync with the other person. You just drop away. And then literally have them feel the quality of the space after doing that. You're in a whole different room. That room now holds you in a different way. You've created something that creates a state that I believe allows these kind of bubbling
effects. Yeah, but so in a way, what you've done is you've described a process of negotiation with the environment. That in a way, instead of feeling overwhelmed by it, victimized by it, and shutting down, you have actually engaged with it, connected with who you are and how you react to it, and then you have more of the possibility to channel your attention.
So, and that you can't forget that relational piece, which is we're mammals. It's wired in. Jim Cohen's research about social baseline theory, he talks about that we... Our baseline is relationship, not the individual. And we are at our best when we are connected to other people. And when we're on our own, we don't have all of our capacities. And so why not, as focusers, utilize that system? Again, not making it one more method, which is going to make it explicit, but really play with that space and enliven that space. I think Jen Lim was pointing towards this. Just not unfolding it in explicit ways, to use that word. Mm-hmm. Maybe David, you know this.
And just to point out the qualification on being with another person, it has to be with another person you can trust.
Absolutely, because otherwise you're in fight, flight, and freeze, and all your alarm signals are going to go off. Yeah, you have to create in attachment terms that sense of accessibility and responsiveness. Accessibility, I can get to you. Responsiveness, you'll be there. And that, will you be there for me when I really need you? You have to actually know that that person is somebody trustworthy. Absolutely.
But so maybe I want to pick up on that point, David, that you mentioned. So you say you have to be with a person that you can trust. Okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe part of getting into that space in a practical way is simply allowing yourself, when in a dialogue, when in a dyadic focusing moment, to really appreciate the existence of that trust, and brush it off, but just stay there and appreciate it, and then you're entering into the space.
Into a space where you trust and are trustworthy.
Yeah.
And where you're not making pronouncements about that. Oh, I hear you, I respect you, all these things I want to happen, but allowing yourself actually to drop down into that place of actual trusting.
Yeah, or maybe a place of checking whether you trust or not.
Exactly. And,
yes.
Exactly. That's right.
And the word that came to me is it takes courage. Mm-hmm. Because too often we like to paint things nice, but it takes courage to say, how are we doing in this moment? My gut gets a sense that something's a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be as small as an eye flicker or a yawn that shows up. That those are the rupture and repair moments that we cannot pass up. Those are the moments that tell our gut, yes, that person is safe, or no, that person isn't safe. And you will never get to a resonant state of something showing up if you don't do that work.
Yes.
Because your implicit gut just will not trust. You'll say the nice words, but you won't mean it.
So maybe that's a good point to make, that as focusers, you know, most focusers would say that focusing involves paying attention to that moment by moment reality, authenticity of what happens. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is that actually in a relationship, in a relational focusing, it's to also really very much pay attention to what's happening between the two of you, And that something has to happen, that, you know, the avoidance of something happening through, you know, maintaining a poker face or something of that nature, is actually going to deprive the conversation of its richness.
And we would just say the implicit picks it up anyway. So, so it's there. And so, I mean, your body doesn't lie, and you'll know it. We've just trained ourselves to not be mean or to not say unkind things or to keep it to ourselves. It's, and I want to use the word intentionally, it's training people that that's okay. That's actually what's wanted. That's the beauty of this. The not getting it right is part of the magic of what's to come.
So I want to pick up on this, to suggest an exercise, and I'm, you know, thinking out loud, and by all means, you know, if I'm not on the same wavelengths, you know, the whole point of this is to say, no, you actually didn't understand a thing about what we're saying. So I want, but maybe to encourage people who are listening to this, when they do focusing with a focusing partner, to make some experiments and to say, okay, what you're going to do next time you focus with your partner is make it as an intention that what you're going to do is simply observing what is happening in the communication, observing the quality of your own presence, lack of presence, trust, distrust, observing what you pick up from the other person and how it makes you feel. And find a way to notice it, find a way to communicate it, find a way to dialogue about it. Understand that it is something that's going to feel very awkward in lots of ways, and might feel dangerous at some moments, because then you're going to let yourself feel some things that we normally don't want to express. And so, you know, probably as a good way to do it is to not necessarily feel you have to express everything in order to create safety. You can, you know, find a way to only express a certain amount, but basically to have that as an experiment in listening to or touching the field, that third person that is there in the relationship.
That's very well said. And to let that discomfort show up, to let it be present, not necessarily to stop in that moment and talk about it or analyze it, but to just let it be a reality, a rupture, if you will, if that's needed, from which repair can happen.
Great.
It's wonderful. And as you were talking about this exercise, another thing that people can do if they just want to play is to do a session of focusing, that's kind of a fun focusing session, where the person who is companioning you holds the space with intention, giving you their full attention, and then at some point looks off in the distance and starts thinking about what they're going to eat for dinner. And all, you know, the eyes are closed to the person who's focusing, and can that person feel the shift? And if they are attuned, you better believe they can. So even just for focusers to know when they're in the companioning role, that just sitting there and attending sends communication that the implicit picks up. And to have fun experiments where you can actually say, I actually felt it. It was that moment when I started talking about this. And, you know, you can open your eyes, kind of like Marco Polo in the pool, you know, caught you, fish out of water. That we can begin to help ourselves trust that when our gut gets that feeling in the interpersonal realm, it's often usually right. And to have someone to practice that with, wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, great. Yeah. So, does it seem like a good place to end? Is there something you want to add?
It's been fun to talk. And I love how you've tracked and just the lax exercise. It's been fun for us.
Thank you.
It's felt like the conversation itself is a bit of what we're talking about.
Yeah. I have a sense of that. That feels nice. Yeah, that was fun to try to practice it as we were talking.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prengel. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.